Thank you for joining us this afternoon. My name is Anam Aftab, Health Promotion Specialist, and I will be moderating today's webinar, Smoke-Free Ontario Modernization, Report of the Executive Steering Committee. For those of you who are logged into our webinar, you will see our presentation on the right, and on the left side of the screen, you will see a chat box. We have set aside time for questions after the presentation, but at any time during the presentation, feel free to enter any question into this box, and we will address them when we can. We may not answer the questions in order, but we will do our best to answer each question at the appropriate time. So before we begin, we would like to get a better sense of how many have joined us today. Please indicate how many people are attending today's webinar with you by clicking on the circle beside the appropriate number. Thank you very much, everyone. Now I would like to introduce you to our presenters, Michael Perley and Dr. Charles Gardner. Dr. Rob Schwartz gave his regrets as he will not be able to attend today's webinar. Michael Perley has been the director at Ontario Campaign for Action on Tobacco since 1993. Mr. Perley's work focuses on tobacco control and public policy. Dr. Charles Gardner is a medical officer of health for the Simcoe Muskoka Health Unit since 2005. Prior to that, he worked in general medical practice for 4 years in communities in Newfoundland and New Brunswick, and a year in Zimbabwe. I will now turn over to our first presenter, Michael Perley.
Well, good afternoon, and thanks for joining us, everyone. We have quite a number of slides, and this is obviously a report that has a lot of detail in it, so we want to leave plenty of time for questions. I assume there are some, for sure. I will go through a portion of the slides, and then Chuck will weigh in with his portion, and then I'll come back later in terms of where we're headed, we being particularly the Ontario campaign, but also public health, and some thoughts, and Chuck has some thoughts as well about what we should be doing to advance this report's status with the government. So, starting with the first slide, I assume that I'll just move them along and people will follow along with me. Is that right, Adam?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, just a few words on the genesis of the Smoke-Free Ontario strategy. And the only reason I mention this is because there have been a lot of numbers tossed around in terms of what it has achieved. And I want to make sure that everyone is clear about what the SFOS actually is. So it began with the 2006 implementation of the Smoke-Free Ontario Act, and there has never been a written strategy. We have a set of pillars: protection, prevention of initiation, protection from secondhand smoke, of course, and smoking cessation. We've often argued that industry denormalization should be part of those pillars, but the government has never accepted that. So from 2006, when the Act was implemented, through to last year, it's been frequently strengthened, as most of you know, with the flavorings ban, the menthol ban on smoking and children with under 16 in cars, these kinds of things. And there have been occasional strengthenings on the enforcement side and improvements in penalties and so on. And so these have been done not according to any particular set of goals or strategies, but rather the pillars are there, and from the advocacy point of view and also from the research point of view, whenever a particular subject has come up that sort of cried out for action, if you like, we've tried to move it forward. So the basis of the report, of our report, was a report by the Smoke-Free Ontario Scientific Advisory Committee, which was set up a number of years ago initially to provide evidence for an exercise somewhat similar to this modernization exercise called the Tobacco Strategy Advisory Group. And it was convened, it was not convened by the Minister of Health at the time, It was convened with the agreement of the Ministry of Health Promotion and Sport, which then had carriage of the tobacco file, to look at the status of the Smoke-Free Ontario strategy and look ahead and recommend improvements and changes to the strategy. That was the first Scientific Advisory Committee, or SAC, and it was dedicated to summarizing the evidence for effective and promising tobacco control interventions. SAC 2.0 was convened a couple of years ago to update that work, and it provides particular advice in a ranking order, that is, high likelihood of success, middling, low, and innovative, which refers to interventions that haven't, of course, been tried yet. And there's advice on which could be adapted for use in Ontario. And SAC 2.0 forms the evidentiary basis for the Executive Steering Committee report. And the committee, which is listed in the report, I assume everybody's had a look at the report, is a cross-section of experts and professional organizations and NGOs. And we had half-day meetings from the end of May through to August. We heard presentations, like, for example, the Ministry of Finance came in and talked about its anti-contraband strategy and what it was doing on taxation and so on, which was useful. And then we debated the leading SAC 2.0 recommendations with input from current research and analyses by OTRU and others, as well as field experience, and the latter was pretty important. And then began to put the report together. Portions of it were being put together as we went along through our meetings. It contains a case for the strategy and a framework, the visions, goals, targets, and the principles guiding the committee's work, which are the usual contents of a report like this. So how can we achieve a modernization of the strategy? This was obviously a key question. We felt that this time around we should be leading with challenging and containing the tobacco industry. And, of course, we'll get to detailed recommendations a little later. But that should be right up front and forceful. And so that became the case. There was, of course, consideration of the cessation issue, especially given the fact that we have a lot of cessation activity going on in Ontario, but I think the word incoherent probably applies to the system itself. So we wanted to look at that. We wanted to prevent more Ontarians from starting to smoke, a fact that I did not know before I got into this exercise myself was that 30,000 Ontarians start smoking every year. I think I'd been assuming that because youth rates were so low that that number was shrinking rapidly. Not the case. So very important. Expand secondhand smoke protection policies, harmful aerosol and protection from harmful aerosols where appropriate from vape products, and of course create a strong enabling system to actually execute the strategy with research and infrastructure. You notice I don't reference cannabis here. We did reference it from time to time through the report, but it was not a major subject or topic for this strategy because there was going to be a separate cannabis strategy. So we looked at priority actions for the first 5 years. We set out an overall 10-year frame and many recommendations, of course, as you're aware if you've looked at the report. So everything was framed and structured around the concept of an end game. That is arising from conclusions from the Endgame Summit in Kingston last September, October last year. Ultimate target, of course, as everyone who's familiar with this knows, less than 5% tobacco use, not smoking, but tobacco use by 2035. This was an interesting, we went through some of this in some detail because if you look at the WHO MPOWER recommendations, which are the sort of baseline recommendations for any country that is embarking on a comprehensive strategy. In our case, in Ontario, OTRU looked at if we completely implemented all the MPOWER recommendations from WHO, where would we wind up? Well, by 2047, we would be down somewhere in the neighborhood of 9%. So you can see, obviously, this is MPOWER is not a set of principles that will get us anywhere near the end game target that was selected. This is interesting. This shows the status quo. If we just keep doing what we're doing right now, no reference to MPOWER, no reference to anything else, any other strategy, any other principles, just keep doing what we're doing, by 2035, we'll be down to about 13%, which is not hugely far away from where we are right now, whereas you can see what it will take and how long it will take to drive down to our target of 5%. It'll have to be a very consistent and gradual decline in prevalence and use and et cetera. So, oops, I went too far there. So the first section, if you like, constraining the tobacco industry. So, of course, we want to increase, and that probably should read dramatically increase the price of tobacco products by tax increases leading to a doubling of current prices, reducing the differential between the tiers of the multi-tier pricing system that the industry began putting in place about 15 years ago, and which has led to significant availability of lower-priced product to those who can better afford a lower-priced product. Banning incentives to retailers to promote discount products. This has been a lead in this area has been demonstrated in Quebec. I think the ban on incentives there, I think those who advocated for it would agree that the industry has managed, as we somewhat expected they probably would, to try and find ways around it, and they've been somewhat successful. But this remains that doesn't mean that's a failure. It just means it's made it a little more difficult for the industry to promote discount product, but hasn't prevented them from doing so. So we need to take advice and recommendations from our Quebec colleagues and do this effectively here in Ontario. We also recommended eliminating tax deductions and other fiscal advantages available to the tobacco industry. Now, a lot of those are under the purview of the federal government, but some are here in Ontario. Things like tax relief from promotional expenses, for example. So there are possibilities there that would help fiscally reduce the industry's advantages. Now, I wanted at this point to interject something that was not directly in the report, but it relates very much to this pricing issue that I think we're all very concerned about at the moment. This is some work done by the Business Intelligence Division at Health Canada, and it shows the difference between the number of individual sticks, cigarettes, that have been produced in Canada since 2001, and the wholesale value. And you can see the number of sticks is shrinking, but the wholesale value is increasing. Why is that? Well, the industry's been raising its own prices. And this, in a sense, is not really a complete surprise in a way, because we've always known when a tax increase is implemented in any jurisdiction in Canada, the industry slips in a little increase in price of its own at the wholesale level to make more money. It helps undermine this kind of data helps significantly undermine the value of the industry's anti-contraband argument. Now, here's another chart This is the unit price of cigarettes in Ontario from 03 to 16. And again, you can see industry revenue has been increasing dramatically on the wholesale level, particularly since 2014. It amounts to about $1 billion a year. So it's just an important aspect of this whole pricing issue that we were concerned with in the report, that the industry is very deliberately, and there's a lot more data on this issue available, the industry is regularly increasing prices more and more drastically as the years go on. So further, in terms of constraining the industry, we want to reduce availability at retail by reducing the number and density of retail tobacco vendors, of which there are about 10,000 in Ontario. Polling indicates that 66% of Ontarians agree with this, and it should be something that the government should seriously consider. We'll get to whether they appear to be or not considering it at a little later on. We also recommended reducing the supply of tobacco products by reducing the amount of tobacco released to the market for sale. So this is literally just cutting off the pipeline right at its source. How much tobacco can actually be provided to retailers? 53% of Ontarians believe sales should either be stopped entirely or phased out in 5 to 10 years. And those numbers are a couple, 3 years old, so they may even be stronger now. And then enhancing unregulated tobacco enforcement, we will see in today's fall, I think today is the fall economic statement, and then in our budget coming up in the spring, how much finance is going to add to the list of interventions that it's using to reduce what we usually call contraband, but which we're trying not to use that term because it does offend our Indigenous partners. So further, on constraining the industry, as you can see, a lot of emphasis on this, implement FCTC, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Controls, Article 5.3, which requires signatory countries to prevent industry involvement in health policy making by, among other things, and this is not a complete list, but to ensure transparency of all government industry contacts and require the industry to disclose information on all of its practices. And this is only, this is a very small snapshot of what 5.3 can do. And we were pretty insistent that that be strongly considered because we're certainly well aware of the industry's lobbying and meetings and so on at Queen's Park, just as they do in Ottawa and all the other provincial capitals. So this is a very important aspect of preventing the industry interfering with policies, including taxation, that have a direct effect on public health. And then I think this is the final one, phase out tobacco growing on non-Indigenous lands in Ontario within 10 years using a mandatory timeline. And just for everyone's background and information here, when the quota system that used to be in place in Ontario for tobacco growing, under which each farmer would have a quota and would have to sell the product grown to the Ontario Flue-Cured Tobacco Marketing Board for a certain set price, that system was phased out in 2007, and money from a settlement for the 1990s smuggling issue that the industry was so deeply involved in, some of the money was used to buy out that quota in 2007 and replace it with a contract licensing system. At that time, tobacco was about being grown at the level of about 26 million pounds in Ontario. It's now close to 60 million pounds as a result of this contract licensing system. So that is definitely an issue that's very much going in the wrong direction. I think that's the end of the slides on the industry. Next is, this is my second section, and then I'll hand over to Chuck, motivating and supporting more Ontario smokers to quit and to stay quit. And this really summarizes, this slide summarizes what this objective should result in. A highly visible and well-promoted, high-quality, person-centered, maybe smoker-centered is the better term, cessation service. All services that can be delivering cessation need to be coordinated. Healthcare, community, population-based services. There need to be systematic referrals so we don't lose track of smokers who may relapse or come into the system briefly and go out. We don't want to lose track of them. We want to expand available services, and we'll get to some I think progress in that area in a little while. We want to significantly increase promotion. This is something where the province has really fallen down on. There is almost a complete absence of promotion of cessation. We have the package warnings, of course, with the Smokers Helpline or the Quitline, National Quitline Service that's delivered in each province on the package. That's helpful, but that's about it in terms of promotion of cessation, which is by no means enough. We need to have robust clinical standards for the delivery of cessation. Health Quality Ontario is going to be doing some work in that area. We know that. How long it will take them to come out with a new set of standards, we're not sure, but it won't be multiple years. And I want to continue to explore the potential of non-combustible nicotine delivery systems to reduce harm for people who are unable or unwilling to quit smoking. That is probably a recommendation that causes some people in the public health community a fair amount of angst, but and others support it strongly. It's one where there's not complete agreement, but we need to continue to explore the potential of these devices. I think that pretty well everyone is agreed that exploration and research should continue. Equitable access to cessation services is really important. Given the increasing number of lower socioeconomic individuals and those with mental health problems and co-addiction problems increasingly occupy the smoking space and make up the smoking population. So they need to have cost-free cessation pharmacotherapies, and our overall services need to be targeted to those with high rates of smoking. I think we all are very much in support of that. So I'll stop there, any questions or comments?
Thank you, Michael. So I'd like to open the floor for questions. Please type your questions in the chat box on the left side of the screen if there are any for Michael for this section.
Well, I certainly see one. The lack of tobacco tax increases is missing in the history of the strategy and not under the SFOS, but at the whim of government. That's true. It is. And we had a long period from 2006 to about 3 years ago when we had very, very minimal tax increases. In fact, the only one I can think of was when the HST was implemented. I think our per carton price went up $3 or $4. It's been interesting because the Ministry of Health, whether it was the old Ministry of Health Promotion and Sport until about 4 years ago, or whether it was the current Ministry of Health and the Public Health and Health Promotion Division, they work with finance, I'll say, of course. The budget for the strategy obviously comes from finance, but I don't think until relatively recently the government as a whole saw tobacco tax increases through the lens of tobacco control. It was more through the lens of this is a product that requires taxation, there are healthcare costs to offset, which have been growing, despite relatively limited growth in taxation revenue. So you're quite right. It has not been officially part of the strategy, but those of us working on the advocacy side and in the NGO world always consider tax increases as a lead advocacy strategy. It's the most effective way of reducing consumption of all interventions we know about. So we consider it part of the strategy, whether the government does or not. Just one final comment. We had a government in office for 8 years that was not interested in any kind of taxation of tobacco products, and that ended in 2003, but we still didn't make a lot of progress until the last 3 or 4 years, again, under the current government. Now the current government has stepped up to the plate on taxation, and we've had a total, including the two remaining portions of the total $10 a carton increase that was announced in this last budget, we've had a total, if you assume that they are going to be implemented and collected, of about $16.25 over the last, it will be a total of, I think, 4 or 5 years. So that's a significant step forward from Ontario, but it took a while for sure.
Okay, there are a few questions for you, Michael.
Yeah.
One of them is, does the tobacco industry increasing its prices when there are tax increases serve tobacco control interests, or should it be limited?
Well, that's another interesting question, because any price increase, one could say, who cares who increases the price? It makes the product less attractive to smokers. But unfortunately, and we still have a lot of work to do in this area, but I don't think it's that simple. What happens is, for example, if the industry, let's say, you know, there's a $5 a carton increase from a government, and the industry is operating under this multi-tier system, what it can do is it can shift the burden of that tax increase to premium products like Du Maurier, Rothmans, and so on, whose smokers, because of their higher price, are presumably less price sensitive. So they can get their price increase by trying not to increase the lower categories of their product, the lower price categories of their products, the discount, as much as they do with the premium product. So that's a way for the industry to offset the the impact, if you like, in terms of cessation on its of its own price increases, and at the same time to then complain constantly, as we've all heard about the levels of contraband. There's another study out today from the Ontario Convenience Store Association asserting, you know, contraband's, as usual, sort of out of control in Ontario. And that's their strategy. So they speak out of both sides of their mouths, and they've done it until relatively recently fairly effectively.
Okay, thank you. Another one. Is there opportunity for public health units to work with Lynn on cessation services?
To work with?
LHINs.
Like local health integration networks. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
We hope so. I don't think it's clear at this point exactly what alignment of the health units with the LHINs will actually look like. I don't see any reason why that wouldn't happen. I don't know that anything is standing in the way of it. I think there'll be some influence on that from Health Quality Ontario's development of new cessation standards of care and delivery. That will impact that to some degree. But look, LHINs are clinically based, if you like, or driven. I don't think there's any reason why appropriate personnel at health units wouldn't be part of that overall effort. It wouldn't make sense to not have them included.
Okay. And does the FCTC Article 5.3 include recommendation of government divesting of investments containing tobacco companies?
No. I don't think that's – I think that's elsewhere in the FCTC. I don't know whether everyone saw the announcement a couple of days ago that the pension fund manager for the Ontario Public Service Employees Union has decided to entirely divest itself of tobacco stocks effective early 2018. This is a big, big move, as you can imagine. So all public service pensions in Ontario will be tobacco-free effective early next year. And divestment is also on the agenda of the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board for consideration very soon. This is part of the largely in the Ontario case, resulting from the work of an organization based in Australia called Tobacco Free Portfolios. I won't go on about that too much. We don't have time today. But it's a very effective, very small organization, but extremely effective, and we're looking at setting up a Canadian office for it. So we hope to have more progress and announcements on divestment in Ontario and elsewhere in Canada over the next year or so, for sure. So it's an important anti-industry strategy, but it's not in Article 5.3.
Okay, thank you. Where is the discussion about having NRT included in the government formulary taking place, or is it taking place?
Yeah, where is it taking place? It would have to be in the Population and Public Health Division, for starters. That would have to have been a strong recommendation to Cabinet based on our report. And then what the decision actually comes down to would be collaboration between finance and health in some way, shape, or form. I think we'll see, I don't think we'll see anything in the fall economic statement on that. It's too soon to have sorted that out, but we all very much look forward to the budget as shedding some light on that. Now, whether it'll be on the formulary, it is part of ODB, but it is not. It's not the prescription meds, that is, are part of ODB, but NRT is not, as you know. And whether they continue with a non-formulary-based distribution system through STOP in the Ottawa model and public health units, or whether they move to the formulary, I don't know that it'll be on the formulary because it's classified as OTC, over-the-counter. So I'm not sure that we'll see that. I think we may well see enhancement of STOP's ability and Ottawa models and other sources' ability to hand out free NRT rather than a formulary-based approach. That's my sense of where this is going. I may be wrong, but I think that's where we are.
Thank you. Do you anticipate public health units having a role in providing cessation to priority populations?
I think so. It's very hard to tell firmly whether that is going to be the case. We have a combination of balls in the air, if you like. We have the new public health standards. We have the alignment with the LHINs. We have this report and potential announcements in the cessation area arising from it. Again, probably not in the fall economic statement, but hopefully in the budget. We have the fact that the whole cessation issue is driven by the Population and Public Health Division, which itself has, as everyone knows, I think, defunded the tobacco-specific and other health promotion resource centers. So is that money going to be available for expansion of cessation services, and will that impact public health? So there are a lot of balls in the air here, so it's not precisely clear. I don't see any. I haven't come across any thinking that public health's role in delivering cessation services should be reduced. but it's just not clear with this change, potential change in alignment with the LHINs and the new standards and so on. It's just not clear exactly what that role will look like going forward, I don't think. Chuck may have a comment there.
One thing I would really point out to people is that these are recommendations that we provided to the minister, and it rests with the minister to determine what to do with them. Certainly our hope is that all of these recommendations that ultimately form a new strategy for the province that they commit to and go forward in time. And certainly local public health participating directly in the provision of smoking cessation services to individuals would be consistent with that, along with many other roles that I will be speaking to in my portion of the presentation.
Great.
Another question. Is there opportunity for collaboration, and are people aware of where to get the help best for them?
Collaboration between?
Public health units, CHC, TAMH, or hospitals.
Yes, on the cessation side, the difficulty we have here, I mean, I say yes, there has to be, but the difficulty is, before our report was prepared, STOP, the Ottawa model, and the Canadian Cancer Society had done some work on their own initiative on integrating the system. And this would have included, of course, public health and so on, but they wanted to make sure that at least their three programs were better integrated. And so they put forward a model, and it was fairly technical, a lot to do with sharing of records and confidentiality issues and technical issues, software. You know, there's a lot of complexity behind collaboration that really works. And we're not sure what status that has in the government at the present time, that report and recommendations just on alignment and integration of those three programs and some others. And we're not sure what role or what effect, rather, the cessation recommendations in the modernization report will have on that that technical report. Like, will it help move it forward and put light a bit of a fire under the appropriate folks at the ministry to allow this integration and better collaboration between all the partners that can deliver cessation to proceed? Right now, we don't have an answer to that. We certainly want that to happen, and when we have opportunities, we push for that to happen, but we haven't got a firm announcement of how it's going to happen, when it's going to happen, who's going to be involved. We're waiting for that still.
Okay, thank you, Michael. So we will have time for questions in the end. Right now, I will just turn over to Dr. Gardner for his presentation.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you today. I will be focusing on topics of prevention, protection, and some of my own thoughts about roles for public health with regards to the recommendations of this report. So with regards to prevention, we're really talking about keeping Ontarians from not starting smoking in the first place. And one of the recommendations is very much focused on comprehensive policies and programs to keep youth and young people from starting smoking, with the initial recommendation of increasing the age of sale to youth to 21. I've color-coded this red because the report segments out recommendations within the first 5 years versus recommendations to be done started within the first 10 years. So anything that you see along the way that is red is of the category of get going within the first 5 years. So this was felt to be important enough to start right away. And if you were to cross-compare it with the evidence in the SAC2 report, it's identified as being innovative, that There's some evidence, certain sources, the Institute of Medicine indicating that they estimate that overall smoking uptake by youth could be reduced as much as 12% with an increase in the age. And certainly the report identifies that ideally this would be done in conjunction with marijuana sales as that becomes legal, and also alcohol, that there should ideally be concurrence between the three. The thinking about 21 relates to the particular vulnerability of youth and the developing brain being particularly vulnerable to nicotine addiction. And that there would be an intensification of tobacco prevention policies and education in elementary, secondary, and post-secondary schools, with a particular emphasis on trade schools. The particular emphasis on trade schools is in recognition of the fact that smoking uptake is higher in individuals that go into the trades. It certainly peaks out in young adults. We've had successes in people in secondary school, but it tends to get away from us as we get into young adult ages, and in particular those who go into the trade. So using youth as partners in this, developing their skills and giving a focus to those in the trades is felt to be important from the point of view of health equity. And reaching youth and youth centers as well is important, because we don't necessarily get those that have dropped out of school. That's another avenue to reach youth, whether or not they're in school. Social exposure to tobacco is important, and one of the recommendation areas deals with on-screen portrayal of smoking in movies. We know that there is quite a bit of social exposure via this means. There's quite a bit of portrayal of smoking in movies that the teenagers and young adults would see, and that this could be reduced significantly for teenagers if there was a requirement for an 18A rating for movies that portray smoking. This was identified in the SAC-2 report as being innovative. There's certainly a body of evidence demonstrating a link between the exposure to smoking in movies and the uptake of smoking in youth, perhaps as much as a doubling of risk. But what is lacking would be the experience of actually implementing this kind of policy in place, hence it being innovative. Going in conjunction with that would be the requirement of theaters to show strong anti-tobacco ads before films. There's evidence showing that that can somewhat nullify the promotional effect of smoking shown in films, that it's seen in a different light after people have seen these sorts of ads. And to take away an incentive for movie producers to portray smoking, it would be helpful to take away any kind of public subsidies that they would be otherwise eligible for in the production of their films. So another area of importance would be campuses, and there is evidence that making post-secondary campuses smoke-free with regards to the actual practice of smoking outdoors on campuses, but also the availability of tobacco and the promotion of tobacco, and for that matter, work fairs that involve the tobacco industry, all of that can help to further denormalized tobacco in that group. And this is, remember, a group in which the use of tobacco takes off. We're talking about young adults. This would be a way of reaching people at their vulnerable point in their lives. And although this would be seen as perhaps a new venture in Ontario and was cited in the SAC-2 report as being something that hasn't been done in Ontario since that time, very recently, McMaster University has committed to becoming smoke-free as of January this year. So certainly they are to be commended for that. We also looked at the home environment and reducing secondhand smoke. So now we're getting into the protection strategies, avoiding exposure to secondhand smoke and also to social exposure. And in this section, we deal not just with tobacco smoke, but other sources of smoke. We start to talk about cannabis as well, and also shisha, and also aerosolized products as well, so e-cigarettes. So the first recommendation is to raise awareness through a public engagement campaign about the importance of smoke-free homes. And this was identified by the SAC2 report as being highly effective and needed to be intensified. A really important intervention from a health equity perspective would be achieving smoke-free multi-unit housing in the province, increasing the number of units that are smoke-free. As much as a fifth of the population in the province lives in multi-unit housing, and they tend to be, although certainly aren't exclusively, lower-income individuals. Certainly, if you're talking about community housing provided by municipalities, we're talking about a vulnerable population, lower-income population. And so this would be, in addition to being highly recommended and recommended to be intensified, it's also important from a health equity perspective. So a modification of the Ministry of Housing's Residential Tenancy Act to allow landlords to evict a tenant who violates a non-smoking provision in a lease agreement would be very helpful, and also to include this kind of content in the optional smoke-free housing clause of the standard lease that the province promotes. So changing the legislation, but also raising awareness among landlords and among municipalities, the operators of community housing, that this would be important for the health of their tenants, as well as having many other benefits with regards to costing associated with their units. The importance of establishing more smoke-free spaces is included in the report. So amending the Smoke-Free Ontario Act to ban vaping and smoking of non-tobacco products, including shisha and cannabis, in all indoor and outdoor settings where tobacco is presently banned is included. And certainly this would be important from a consistency perspective. This was, with regards to vaping, identified in SAC2 as being innovative. And in terms of water pipes and shisha, identified as being at a moderate level of evidence and recommended to be intensified. The takeaway about shisha is that smoke is smoke, cannabis smoke is smoke. Whether or not there's tobacco content in the smoke, it still has the same harmful content from the perspective of carcinogens and general toxins and cardiovascular impacts, and it's important from a health protection perspective that we be consistent in that way. It's also important from a denormalization perspective that it be consistent in that way as well. And that kind of thinking is being also extended, I would say, to the e-cigarettes and the vaping as well. There was a question earlier about whether or not it could be used, vaping could be used to assist people in quitting smoking. You might recall from Michael's presentation earlier that there was provision about a harm reduction approach and non-smoke administered nicotine as a strategy. That would be separate from the business of keeping this from happening within areas, indoors and outdoors, that are presently required to be smoke-free under the Smoke-Free Ontario Act. Establishing more smoke-free spaces, amending the Smoke-Free Ontario Act, prohibiting tobacco, shisha, and cannabis within a 9-meter buffer zone around entrances, exits, windows, and air intakes in public buildings, identified under SAC2 as being of high evidence and recommendation for its intensification. The issue here would be the further denormalization of tobacco, the further promotion of people, assisting people and supporting people to quit, and the further protection of air quality, both outdoor as people enter these premises, but also the potential for inadvertent intake of smoke into public building spaces. And also, again, restating the recommendation of protecting the outdoor spaces on post-secondary school campuses. This had been stated earlier in my presentation, framed from the point of view of helping people not to start smoking in the first place. It's also helpful from the perspective of protecting people from secondhand smoke exposure. And once again, with emphasis that this should include trade schools. Outdoor workers, these are people who have high rates of tobacco use, and in SAC2, it was identified that expanding smoke-free spaces to prohibit smoking in outdoor workplaces would be highly effective and should be intensified. If you look at the evidentiary base for this, it's very much from the perspective of assisting people in quitting smoking, and that there's a net impact, measurable impact on cardiovascular mortality associated with putting in place such legislation or policies. So beyond changes to the Smoke-Free Ontario Act, that employers should develop effective smoke-free outdoor workplace policies as well, and that this, of course, the requirement that such would be enforced. So roles for public health, and here I'm talking about the totality of the report and all its recommendations, and I'm talking about whether or not the report is accepted and implemented by the province, the timing, whether it's done now or whether it's done later or whether it's done in part. I crafted some thoughts of my own with all of that in mind, trying to cover off all of that. And also thinking of public health as being local public health units, but also TCANs and Public Health Ontario, the resource centers, Cancer Care Ontario, and of course the Population Public Health Division. Mostly, though, I'm focusing on local public health units with my recommendations. So we always assess local reality. We always assess the needs that exist locally. We do our surveillance. We do our reporting. It helps us with our awareness-raising campaigns, with our advocacy to the province and others for change. It helps us with our own direct service delivery. So in the context of an endgame being accepted as a provincial strategy, the local assessment would be helpful in identifying how well those strategies are working, to what degree they are actually being implemented, whether there are priority populations that are being left behind that need particular attention, that aren't being reached in some way, that need some local action or need some advocacy back to the province for further action. So advocacy, of course, is a very big part of public health, particularly boards of health. And advocacy can be directed to a number of recipients. We are very closely aligned with municipalities. Our boards of health are made up. The majority members are made up of municipal representatives. And municipalities have had a long-standing history of leading the way when it's come to innovation on new public policy that eventually is taken up by the province because it's been shown to be effective and because it's become distributed across the province. So I anticipate municipalities should continue to play that role. Local boards of health should continue to encourage and support them on this, whether it's with regards to the restriction, prohibition of water pipe use in indoor public spaces or workspaces, the policies that they would have for community housing, smoke-free community housing, the potential for extending the areas of restriction beyond their immediate entrances of their premises. when it comes to private housing, that there could be advocacy to the operators of such municipalities or private operators, that they take on policies and leases that would protect spaces, make spaces smoke-free in these units. There was a question earlier about LHINs and whether we should be working with local health integration networks and hospitals, and I would say that we most definitely should be. I can proudly say that in Simcoe Muskoka, we have approached our two local health integration networks and made the case to them that they should require their hospitals to implement the Ottawa models for smoking cessation. So that recommendation has been delivered to them. It's with them for their consideration. So to me, it's totally fair game for us to be advocating to that particular group. We're cited right within Patients First, within changes in our own enabling legislation, the Health Protection and Promotion Act, positioning medical officers of health and boards of health to be advising the CEOs of LHINs on health programming. To me, this is an extension of that kind of thinking. When it comes to advocacy to the province, we should continue to advocate for a tobacco endgame approach to the revision, renewal of Smoke-Free Ontario, the creation of a Smoke-Free Ontario strategy that encompasses the recommendations of this report. I think that taxation increases is probably the most important element of the strategy that the province should pursue. Therefore, I would certainly support boards of health advocating this to the province. All of the price strategies that are identified, all the industry addressment strategies of this report should certainly be implemented, and boards of health should be advocating for that. Boards of health have been very active on advocating about cannabis. Our report touches on cannabis and in a few places. It's really from the perspective of we're talking primarily about tobacco and tobacco smoke. There are other sources of smoke that come into the picture, including cannabis, and so how do we handle them as a package? There are other aspects of cannabis that we do not touch on. It's intoxicating effects that also are a public health matter. So that we're, certainly public health should be addressing that with advocacy in its totality. And from the point of view of this report, should be addressing it with regards to smoke exposure. Same with water pipes, heat not burn products, so new products from the industry that are an attempt of the industry to find a loophole to work around. We need to be keeping up with the industry and our advocacy to the province about including such products in the legislation prohibiting their use in indoor public places, workplaces, spaces that are included already in the Smoke-Free Ontario Act, and the new spaces that we're suggesting in this report be smoke-free. And, of course, advocacy about smoke-free movies, continued work, advocacy that province close the loop with regards to where people can use e-cigarettes. We need to be supporting the resource centers. We certainly should advocate that they continue. They've played at a critical role in tobacco control for many, many years, and the strategy itself identifies the need to have a resource and knowledge exchange base to nurture the strategy as it goes forward. And we need to continue advocating for an augmentation of the cessation supports and systems in the community. We can advocate nationally. We can advocate that the federal government actually proceed with an endgame strategy. They've had a discussion paper out there. Many have given comment back. We can continue to do that. We can continue to advocate that they continue to increase tobacco taxation federally. And also another aspect of all of this we've not touched on is plain packaging. That rests with the federal government. They can certainly proceed with that. That's been found to have a strong evidentiary base and should be implemented according to the findings of SAC 2. So a lot of our advocacy work depends on the public being aware and supportive, and so raising awareness with the public about the importance of smoke-free movies, about smoke-free housing. We've had, a lot of our successes locally about smoke-free housing have arisen because tenants have come to us and asked for help, and we've advocated that they advocate, and that's set grounds for municipalities to move forward with smoke-free community housing policy. We raise awareness around social supply. We need to continue to do that, such as the Bad Ways to Be Nice initiative, and promote cessation, get behind our cessation systems as they develop, and continue our work with schools and school boards around the education of youth. Knowledge exchange, of course, is going to be critical all the way through. The roles that Public Health Ontario plays, the resource centers. Keeping SAC 2 ever fresh is an important process that the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit has taken leadership on, along with Public Health Ontario. So that's a wise thing to do, keep that up, because we need to continue to monitor the emerging evidence about water pipes, about e-cigarettes, about cannabis, and everything else related to this topic. Those areas that SAC2 identified as innovative someday will become highly recommended with a strong evidentiary base, but only if we continue to monitor all of that. We need to, when the province proceeds with committing to endgame strategies, we need to monitor the impacts as they roll out. Enforcement. In addition to the enforcement that we have done all along and will continue to do, we need to be prepared to increase and extend our enforcement to include the new content that we're recommending when it comes into place, should it come into place, whether it's with regards to e-cigarettes, or shisha, or other products like Heat Not Burn. That, for example, Heat Not Burn, the marketing of that, the devices themselves can be put on display, and we've advocated that they also not be promotable in that kind of way, not just the combustible portion of the product. And we need to be prepared for any extension to other outdoor environments as recommended in the report. Cannabis, coming next year in July, and I would anticipate that we would have a role that would require, probably wise to be in collaboration with the police. We shall see exactly what's required, but I'm sure a cooperative approach with others such as police would be warranted. And same thing with further tax increases, that where we can be working in collaboration with the Ministry of Finance and tipping them off when we see evidence of the avoidance of taxation, inappropriate avoidance of taxation, that we can be working together to reinforce that strategy, that critical strategy for tobacco control. Cessation. We had a question earlier about whether or not we should be involved. I'd indicated that, indeed, I think we should be directly involved. It's all hands on deck with this, basically. You want a comprehensive system where, all players in the system have a role to play in supporting cessation. I think that should include us as well as direct providers, but also that we play our role of advocacy for the development of such a system or the promotion of it as it evolves. Maybe we have the ability to link with our family health teams in this, maybe further linkages with LHINs, such as putting in place the requirement for all LHINs to require all hospitals to be abiding by the Ottawa model for smoking cessation. Of course, we can play roles in bolstering training of providers, bringing in people such as Andrew Pipe and others from the Ottawa Heart Institute, the OMA and others to be assisting with training, CAMH to be assisting with training of providers, PTCC, et cetera. So I can see many, many roles for us, and I'm sure that you can see many others that I've missed. Public health is heavily involved and plays a strong leadership role with tobacco control. In my mind, as we move forward with an uptake and a renewal of Smoke-Free Ontario strategy that hopefully would be very much based on this report, that we would have all the more work to do. And so my final slide, it features a couple of pictures of Heather Crow. It always grounds me. She was an advocate over a decade ago who contracted lung cancer from exposure to secondhand smoke and her work, and really was very, very courageous person to come forward and lead in awareness raising and helped us bring into place the Smoke-Free Ontario Act in the first place. Just a reminder that we've made progress, and we certainly hope to continue to make progress, that to make the kind of progress we want, we need provincial commitment to the to an endgame strategy and the strategies that we've identified in this SFOA modernization report. Happy to take questions and comments.
Thank you, Dr. Gardner. We do have a few questions for you. So with cannabis coming under the Ontario Cannabis Retail Corporation, are we missing an opportunity to sell tobacco only in specified tobacco retailers and not on every street corner if we are saying that it is the only product that, if used as directed, kills half of all users?
So certainly in our section on addressing the industry, we've advised that there be a reduction in retail, the number of retailers, that there be the potential to apply registration costs to retailers so that there would be a reduction in the number, that there would be the potential to look at zoning, to remove them from vulnerable locations. All of that, I think, is important. Whether or not we could get to yet a more innovative strategy, which would further centralize and reduce and control retail, is certainly open to question. If you look at SAC 2, it identifies such strategies, noting them to be innovative, that they haven't been tested, but that they're worthy ideas for consideration.
Another question. The ministry has repeatedly stated that public health units should not advocate their funders, that is, Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, and the federal government, a position that counters our rich history of advocacy in tobacco control. As a medical officer of health, how do you respond to this?
Well, it is my understanding that the ministry has never said that boards of health should not advocate or that medical officers of health should not advocate. I think that my understanding is that they place a restriction on the 100% funding that they provided for tobacco control. So we retain means of advocacy, and I totally agree that it's our time-honored role and a very critical and important role that we've always played and will always play, that we advocate for healthy public policy, including on tobacco control. Probably our safest and most potent means of doing so is through our boards of health and medical officers of health. And, of course, is working with partners as well, other partner agencies that can play that role.
Is there evidence or best practice for legislation to ban smoking in shared housing?
There is evidence with regards to multi-unit housing. There's evidence also with regards to single-unit housing that the restriction of smoking or prohibition of smoking in those environments, whether it's, if it's individual homes that you're promoting to them that they voluntarily do that, if you're talking about multi-unit dwellings, you can make it a policy that they do that. They can make it a condition of their lease that they do that. There's evidence that that is an effective way of reducing exposure and improving health.
And is there a role for mass media or public education campaigns?
So mass media is identified as a critical component of our recommendations, supporting all elements of the recommendations. You need a branding for this new initiative, this new renewed, modernized Smoke-Free Ontario strategy, that it should have its recognized, it should be recognizable by the public. It should be supporting the means by which people can quit smoking, what's at their disposal to quit smoking, that they should not be exposing others to their secondhand smoke in their home, that they should take it outside, they shouldn't be engaging in social supply of youth, probably some awareness raising around untaxed tobacco being illegal and the harm that it does. I would advocate that there be some awareness raising along the lines of denormalization and an awareness of what the industry is doing. The goal of the strategy would be helpful as well. Everybody having a vision of where we're heading and the importance of it, the numbers of lives that will be saved, the dollars saved, all of that. Also supporting tobacco tax increases, that there would need to be, I think, awareness raising about the importance of that, the rationale for that, using the full range of media at your disposal as well, so not just mass media, but also social media and public engagement, and use of stakeholders as propagators of ideas and generators of ideas. All of that is identified as a critical piece of the strategy, the recommendations of in the report.
Thank you. For our T10 Enforcement Subcommittee task of taking on advocacy activities in 2018, which of these protection recommendations are best to focus on? That is, where would our efforts be best served in achieving implementation?
I'm afraid I'm not quite getting the question. And let me just have a look at it again. I think it would, at this point, it comes back to, do you have the freedom to advocate at the TCAN level? I'm not sure how much freedom you have. I've taken this report to my Board of Health and advocated that the province commit to a strategy and that have all of the content that's within the overall recommendations incorporated into the strategy. So to me, merely getting the province to move on having a strategy and having that kind of content is critical. Using boards of health to do that is important. The Council of MOHs of Ontario would be another means by which we could advocate, same with ELSA, same with OPHA. So I don't know if we really want to be segmenting down and focusing on particular elements within the recommendations yet at this point. If you don't get movement on the entire product, I think at that point we might be asking ourselves, okay, we're now into working with this document, even though it's not been committed to by the province, and so what among all of this do we want to be segmenting and working on one at a time for our advocacy? So I'd suggest that could come at some point in the future, but at this point, I think what we really want to get on the agenda is that the province adopt a strategy and that it be based on our recommendations as a whole.
Okay, thank you. And we will take one last question. So at T10 meetings, the director of Smoke-Free Ontario was quite directive that SFO dollars should not be spent on advocating to the government, that is their funders, and SHRAF is losing its funding. What can we do collectively to move commercial tobacco control forward?
So I can see that people certainly feel frustration with restrictions on advocacy. I think that using elements of public health that don't have restriction, boards of health, medical officers of health, your partners, OPHA, ALFA, Council of MOHs, using those elements that remain able to advocate, using them as your channel by which you could advocate would be a way to go.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Gardner. So I will now turn over to Michael for his next section of the presentation.
Okay. Well, thank you. And that was great, Chuck. Thanks very much there for your review. I'd like to talk a little more about sort of where we are sort of on the ground and practically speaking today. Chuck has painted an excellent picture of where we need to go a little further down the road in terms of making this report a reality and continuing to use it as a baseline advocacy tool. I want to talk about where we are as far as we know today. And I should just indicate as background that there has been a submission go to Cabinet based on the report, and that would have been a submission on recommended portions of the report for the government to act on for the remainder of this mandate. So that is to June 7th of next year. Beyond that, all bets are off until we see what the result of the election is. So we have Bill 174, which I think everyone's aware of, and for those who aren't, it is a comprehensive bill that includes the cannabis strategy, the Smoke-Free Ontario Act, and which incorporates the former Electronic Cigarettes Act into the Smoke-Free Ontario Act. And the only recommendation from our report, to our knowledge, that's included in Bill 174 is the ban on tobacco-branded paraphernalia, you know, lighters with Du Maurier on them and that kind of thing. No other legislative recommendations from the report are included in Bill 174. And there is also no indication that the government has endorsed or accepted the report as a whole. There's no statement that we're aware of coming out of Cabinet or anywhere else, Premier's Office or anywhere else, Minister of Health, endorsing the report, either its general direction or any specific recommendations. And I have one caveat to that last statement, which is, as far as we know, there will be some expansion of cessation services, particularly STOP and the Ottawa model, but it's not clear, particularly with STOP, whether that expansion means that the program will be able to hire more people to work with other sites around the province to get them ready to distribute free NRT, because it's not clear that there is, in terms of my former earlier comments about the funding and the need for budget approval in the spring for more money for NRT, it's not clear that the expansion that we understand has been approved of STOP and the Ottawa model actually includes, as well as expanding the services, expanding the amount of product they can give out, which may seem a bit odd, but that's our understanding. Now, as Chuck mentioned, the Tobacco-Specific Health Promotion Resource Centers, TCHO, True, NSRA, SHAP, PTCC, and YATI should be included in that list, will be defunded beginning 1st of April. That doesn't mean they suddenly stop operation. There is wind-down money for a number of months, as far as we understand it, but that is our understanding of the situation at the moment. So the question then becomes, well, what happens to that money? Does it go into expanding cessation services recommended in the report, or does something else happen to it? We don't know at this point for sure, but we expect that that money will be used to expand STOP and Ottawa model. Now, in terms of advocacy, we want to make sure that since obviously the election platforms are being prepared now and being rolled out, we are meeting with the various officials from the three parties who are in charge of their platforms to make sure that they're aware of this report and that it be included, or significant parts of it be included in their election platforms. As I mentioned, possible amendments to Bill 174, but we can possibly have amendments to it. That will depend on what Cabinet made of the submission that went forward. We don't know a lot of detail about that, of course, because of cabinet confidentiality. But we don't know whether there is any latitude on the part of the Minister of Health to call for amendments to the bill and or, as in the case, for example, of shisha, issue a regulation prescribing shisha as a product to be regulated under the Smoke-Free Ontario Act. The reason I mention regulations separately is that while the bill, presumably, given it has the cannabis strategy in it, will be approved before the end of this session on December 14th, regulations can come out anytime a minister wants. They usually try and bring them out in January and July as groups. That's what the Liberals have been doing for a number of years. So if there's to be a shisha ban by regulation, it would have to be done in January, presumably. Is that permissible? Is the Minister of Health have latitude to do that? Well, we don't know yet, and we hope to find out sooner than later. As I mentioned, we need additional funding for pharmacotherapies and other aspects of the SFOS in the 2018 pre-election provincial budget. So that will be a focus of what we're doing. And we'd like to see questions in the legislature and continuing petitions being read regarding smoke-free movies and multi-unit dwellings and their smoke-free status. So there are a number of things that we'll be doing. Chuck gave you a really great and detailed menu for possibilities for public health advocacy, not just in the short term, but longer term. I think one thing that would really help, and I was just trying to limit my recommendation to vis-a-vis public health advocacy to really important recommendation, which would be a unified and visible demand from provincial medical officers of health regarding endorsement and implementation of the report as soon as possible. I believe the medical officers of health and others got a lot of coverage for their call for an opioid strategy, and we know that the province has spent a lot of time on that and has developed and evolved that strategy. So the medical officers of health are probably the highest profile public health officials who have the ability as a group to advocate without restriction, as again Chuck very helpfully explained in detail, I think, and we would love to see that. I think that would be a terrific step forward to raise the profile and continue to keep the profile up of the report. So that really is it. I just wanted to keep that short and sweet, and so I'd be happy to answer any questions, and perhaps we can have them directed at either Chuck or I.
Yes. So we do have a few questions. Why in the amended SFOA is only medical cannabis included?
Well, the federal legislation legalizes recreational. It focuses on any kind of cannabis in terms of where it can be smoked. So it doesn't just regulate medical cannabis in terms of where it can be smoked. There are some exceptions for where medical cannabis can be used indoors, like designated smoking rooms and long-term care facilities. In other words, the same exemptions are allowed for medical cannabis that are allowed for tobacco smoking under the SFOA, but the large majority of indoor spaces are to be cannabis-free as well as tobacco-free, so I'm not sure that it only regulates medical cannabis. It regulates the use of cannabis anywhere.
Yeah. Hi, it's Chuck. I wonder if it's a matter of timing. I mean, here I'm speculating. I'm not on the inside of the the ministry and thus don't know for sure, but I have heard discussion before in which they regulate what is now legal, and medical cannabis is presently legal, versus recreational is not, and so their ability to put out new legislation about something that is yet to become legal and to make it public is limited. So
right.
That may
it's a matter
be
of timing.
Issue.
No, you're right.
It's just a matter of timing.
Yeah, it is a matter of timing. You're right, of course. Yeah. Because I know, in principle, we're very clear that Bill 174, I should have said, will ultimately apply to all kinds of cannabis, recreational and medical. It's just that right now, as Chuck says, it's not formally right now, it's not legal, and it won't be for another 7 months.
Hey, thank you. What happens to this report after the provincial election?
That's a very good question.
We'd rather they took action on it now, but...
It's a very good question because governments, incoming new governments, typically have a history of ignoring reports and recommendations from bodies constituted by their predecessors. So we've taken some pains to convey to the Conservatives and the NDP, but particularly the Conservatives, that this was a panel convened by the Liberal Minister of Health, but it was an expert panel based on evidence. This was not in any way a partisan exercise. Now, that may or may not have any impact. I would be concerned for the future of the report if we have a change in government. The future utility of it, the future value of it, the future usefulness of it. My experience over a long period of time is that governments look to their own reports and their own experts, whatever the value of preceding reports and experts and so on, they tend to go with the exercises that they have constituted themselves. Now, does that mean this suddenly has no value if the Liberals are no longer the government on June 8th? It doesn't mean it has no value, and it certainly doesn't mean that SAC 2 has no value. I think SAC 2 remains the compendium of evidence that it always was. Is there any indication of any kind of partisan flavor to our report? None whatsoever. So I think what we would want to do is carry it forward very vigorously to the next administration, if there is a new one, but with the caveat that I just mentioned, that is our experience in the past.
And I would add, if nothing else, it's, a very well-articulated vision of some actions that need to happen. It's taking the compendium of evidence from SAC 2 and identifying, okay, what are the things that, in an organized way, in a stepwise fashion, between now and a future date with an end goal in mind, 2035, less than 5% use, how do we get there? How could we get there? It is helpful for us in the field to have that kind of a vision for advocacy on elements of it, if not the whole of it. Obviously, it would be much preferable for our government stated support for it and commitment to it, but without that, it still has that rallying cry value for us in the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, if we get the kind of push, if the government changes and we get the kind of pushback that I described, sort of it's not ours, and we didn't commission it and whatever, exactly as Chuck has said, we would respond with, look, this is not a partisan document. This is based on evidence. This is representative of the best current thinking in tobacco control in this jurisdiction. Without regard to who commissioned it or why it was initiated or anything like that. So we would push back very hard on that. But you can push back only so far before new administrations just say, look, we'll do our own work in this area when we're ready. So I don't want to be too negative, but that is, in my experience, what normally happens.
One other thing I would put out is Michael had rightly identified that the MOHs of the province need to advocate on this. And at our last meeting as a group, I took forward that motion, which was approved by them, so I anticipate that there will either be a statement of support from COMO or from ELSA incorporating COMO. So that is coming.
Good. Great.
Thank you, Michael and Dr. Gardner. So in the interest of time, we will wrap up and conclude at this time. I would like to thank everyone who joined the webinar, and thank you once again to Michael and Dr. Gardner. Just to let everyone know that following this webinar, you will be sent an email that will contain a link to an evaluation survey. If everybody could kindly take a few moments to complete the evaluation, it would be greatly appreciated. The slide deck, as well as the audio and the video recordings of the webinar, will also be made available on our website after the webinar. So thank you once again for attending, and have a great day, everyone.
Hello.